on the lunar module. However, certainly we would not want to attempt to go out and do a rendezvous without a backup system. There are other backup modes, one of which involves the use of radar information from radars tracking on the ground. There is a reckoning, a so to speak, dead reckoning system that the astronauts can use themselves that allows them to rendezvous. But the prime rendezvous system, the one which has the greatest possibility of achieving rendezvous with the minimum of fuel consumption, it does involve the rendezvous radar and the guidance system.
Thank you very much for explaining it to us. Dick Fenner, the radar subsystems manager for Project Apollo. This is Rhett Turner in Houston.
Bill Land, do you have anything to add to the rendezvous radar and its backup systems?
Well, I think Dick Fenner did an excellent job in describing the rendezvous radar, and he also mentioned the backup systems that we have. I might just add that we have considerably more backups than you might imagine. He mentioned two of them, the dead reckoning system, which is really the last backup available. But there are two backups prior to that, one of which he mentioned, the ground tracking. The manned spaceflight network stations can track the spacecraft and relay that information to Houston, where it's computed, and Houston can send back the information to the two spacecraft and tell them how to get together. That is, what maneuvers would have to be performed to conduct the rendezvous. Now, this is very simply done, and it's done even when the rendezvous radar is operative, just as a check on how the systems on board are working. Now, another backup which is available is within the spacecraft, not the lunar module that has the rendezvous radar, but the command module. The command module can conduct the rendezvous or direct the lunar module to conduct it based upon ranging with the VHF ranging system. In fact, this is quite appropriate to mention because we did have the communications difficulty originally where the two spacecraft were evidently on the wrong VHF channel. Now, by putting themselves on the same channel, they now have communications through this very high-frequency mode, but by switching from communications to a ranging mode, the command module can actually get a range on the lunar module and know where it's located. And this would then be another backup to the rendezvous radar.
What is the range of the rendezvous radar in nautical miles?
Well, the specification range for it, I believe, is about 400 miles. I know that it's roughly double the separation distance during the rendezvous, and during the rendezvous maneuver, we don't get too much further than about 200 or 250 miles. So I believe that's right, that 400 miles, which represents considerably more than the distance we will ever separate on rendezvous.
You're listening to the Voice of America's continuous coverage of the flight of Apollo 12, now 142 hours, 40 minutes into the mission. Lunar module Intrepid, now making the maneuvers that will eventually take it back to docking with the mother spaceship Yankee Clipper. We'll return to our live coverage of this event, but first let's go to the Voice of America newsroom.
The men of Intrepid have left the moon on the first step of the long journey home. Apollo 12 moon explorers Charles Pete Conrad and Alan Bean blasted off from the lunar surface in their shuttlecraft Intrepid, as scheduled, a little more than one half hour ago. They climbed swiftly to lunar orbit. Now they are maneuvering the spider-shaped Intrepid towards rendezvous and docking with Yankee Clipper, the command ship piloted by Richard Gordon, who has been in lonely lunar orbit for the past day and a half. Officials on Earth say they are delighted with the work of Conrad and Bean. During their 32 hours on the moon, the crewmen left Intrepid twice for a total of more than 7 hours walking about the lunar surface. Working, joking, and occasionally singing, the men set up scientific experiments, collected rocks and dust, and retrieved parts of the nearby American Surveyor 3 moon probe, which landed on the moon nearly 3 years ago. A Nigerian airliner crashed and burned with the loss of all passengers and crew as it prepared to land at Lagos on a flight from London. Correspondent Fred Brown reports from Lagos that the plane carried 75 passengers and a crew of 10. Airline officials told Mr. Brown that the plane was flying at 2,200 feet, 660 meters, when it made its last radio contact 5 minutes before the scheduled landing time at Lagos. News dispatches from London identified the plane as a VC-10 and reported that the passengers were mostly Nigerian Airlines personnel returning to Lagos. Radio Vienna reports that two men, presumably of Polish nationality, hijacked a Polish airliner with 18 persons aboard and forced the pilot to land the plane in the Austrian capital. The broadcast said the hijackers used a toy pistol and two fake bombs to commandeer the plane. They are being questioned by Vienna police. The airliner, according to the broadcast, was on a scheduled flight from Warsaw to the Czechoslovak city of Bratislava, just across the river Danube from Vienna. At the Vietnam talks in Paris, American Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge called once more for serious negotiations to end the war. He noted that the United States has proposed a mutual withdrawal of all outside forces from South Vietnam within 1 year, and he said the United States would be prepared to consider any proposal for a mutual withdrawal even sooner to end the Vietnam conflict. The communist side insisted once more on a unilateral withdrawal of U.S. troops and a dissolution of the Saigon government. The communist delegates also accused the United States of innumerable mass murders and other crimes of war. The Viet Cong delegate, Madam Nguyen Thi Binh, described Mr. Nixon's timetable for withdrawal of U.S. troops as nothing but a treacherous maneuver. The South Vietnamese delegate, Pham Dong Lam, charged that the communists have blocked all efforts to achieve peace and urged immediate, serious talks to bring about an end to the war. There was no major combat reported in South Vietnam today, but enemy gunners continued shelling Allied positions in the Bu Prang area of the Central Highlands near the Cambodian border. The stepped-up fighting last week was reflected in the highest casualty figures for both sides in about 2 months. The communists lost about 3,000 men, the South Vietnamese 497, and the Americans 113 for the week ending last Saturday. Three Israeli civilians were reported wounded when their car was ambushed and attacked by Arab guerrillas near the village of Jabalia in the occupied Gaza Strip. Egyptian and Israeli forces again engaged in heavy artillery exchanges across the southern sector of the Suez Canal, and Jordan said its forces exchanged artillery fire with Israeli troops near the King Hussein Bridge and earlier prevented an Israeli patrol from crossing the Jordan River to the east bank. Israel says it has recovered, or rather has uncovered, two Arab guerrilla groups operating in occupied Hebron and Jerusalem and arrested most of their members. Chile's armed forces are on a state of alert in Santiago province, which includes the capital. There has been unrest in Chile's armed forces. Some elements are reported demanding faster action on pay increases. The raises were promised after a recent revolt by an army unit. The United States and the Soviet Union held their second working session of the Strategic Arms Limitation Talks in Helsinki, this time at the Soviet Embassy. The closed Helsinki meetings are described as preliminary and exploratory, with each nation seeking a basis for future substantive talks. Last night, the two delegations got together at a reception jointly sponsored by the American and Soviet embassies. About 80 Finnish guests, including President Urho Kekkonen, attended. Brazil is celebrating the 1,000th soccer goal scored by national hero Pelé before more than 100,000 spectators in Rio de Janeiro's Maracanã Stadium. The government will issue special postal stamps, and Pelé will receive a gold soccer ball and other honors to commemorate the occasion. British Prime Minister Harold Wilson will visit Washington January 27th to confer with President Nixon. It will be the Labour Party leader's first visit to the United States since Mr. Nixon became president early this year. The two leaders are expected to discuss Vietnam, NATO, and a proposal by the Warsaw Pact for talks on European security. French President Georges Pompidou has scheduled a visit to Washington in February. The United Nations has approved a report by Secretary General U Thant on the decision of West Irian to join the Republic of Indonesia. The decision culminated a 1962 agreement between Indonesia and the Netherlands to establish the future of the area through self-determination. President Nixon told representatives of United States and World Relief Organizations that the number of the world's homeless has increased by 3 million during the past 10 years. The latest United Nations report puts the number of world refugees at 17 million. The president's message was delivered to a two-day Washington conference of representatives of 76 U.S. refugee relief agencies and several international organizations. The president praised work done by the organizations in resettling refugees as a rare and inspiring international achievement. The General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, GATT, has urged its members to begin preparations for a new round of tariff cuts and trade liberalization moves. Director Oliver Long said the trade group has produced a high degree of order and stability in trade relations, and that trade between nations increased 121% in the decade beginning in 1958. The free market price of gold fell below $37, the lowest in almost 2 years, as selling increased in London, Zurich, and Paris. New confidence in European currencies is given as the reason. British Defense Secretary Dennis Healey says Catholic and Protestant extremists will be excluded from joining the new Ulster Police Force being formed to replace Northern Ireland's Protestant-dominated Special Reserve Police. The new force will not be used for riot duties in urban areas. The commander of the Soviet missile forces, Marshal Nikolai Krylov, says that its weapons can hit any part of the world quickly and accurately. He made the statement in an interview marking Soviet Missile Forces Day. Two East Germans who hijacked a Polish airliner and forced it to fly to the French section of West Berlin will be tried by a French military government court today. News reports say the trial reflects Allied determination to keep the vital Berlin airspace free of incidents that could threaten right of access to the communist-encircled city. President Nixon's Director of Communications, Herbert Klein, told a New York meeting of radio and television executives that the administration has no intention of interfering with news presentation. He said Vice President Spiro Agnew recently raised the question of journalistic objectivity because the general public questions the credibility of the news media. Congress has approved a major change in the draft law. It will permit the administration to set up a lottery system next year. And Secretary of Defense Melvin Laird says the plan is to draft only 19-year-olds in another year. Friday's vote on the confirmation of Judge Clement Haynsworth to the Supreme Court is expected to be close. Two leading Republicans announced Wednesday they will split their votes, with Senator George Aiken of Vermont in favor and Senator John Williams of Delaware opposed. An airliner with 14 persons aboard crashed into a mountainside during a rainstorm near Glen Falls, New York, on a flight from Albany. First reports said there were no survivors. A mild earthquake was felt in the Appalachian Mountain area of the southeastern United States, with a center on the border of Virginia and West Virginia. The National Broadcasting Company says it has learned that the Health, Education, and Welfare Department will announce that foods containing cyclamates will be allowed to continue on sale, with a warning label that they should be consumed only upon the advice of a physician. That is the news. This is Clark Thornton reporting on The Voice of America.
This is The Voice of America's continuous coverage of the flight of Apollo 12. Now, 142 hours and 52 minutes into the mission. Lunar Module Intrepid left the lunar surface about 48 minutes ago and is performing the maneuvers that will take it back to the mothership Yankee Clipper. Command Module Pilot Dick Gordon has been performing the duties of the two other astronauts while they were on the lunar surface, and also will have some other duties when they get back, such as a photographic mission to photograph some future landing sites. Rut Turner talked with him a few days ago in Houston. Here's their conversation.
Dick, we've heard much discussion about the importance of all of this photography to be done on the last day in lunar orbit, after rendezvous, after the lunar module returns, after Pete and Al are back in the command module with you, when you prepare to dispense with the lunar module. Basically, all of this photography is to help future missions, right?
It certainly is, and I think it's a very vital aspect of this flight. It's an added feature, you might say, of our flight, and if you really look at it, it's exactly what Apollo 8 did on their flight. We've tacked that on as an addition to ours. But in that's an indication, I think, only of the amount of activity we'll be doing. And it is all basically surveying and basically photography for future Apollo flights. I think to make the future of Apollo interesting, captivating, and certainly scientifically valuable, we must go to the areas on the lunar surface that are the most interesting significantly as far as geology is concerned. Mm-hmm. Now, proposed landing sites for future missions have been three areas that we are vitally interested in. One of them is Lalande.
Now, what is this, a crater area?
Yes, these basically are highland areas. They are crater areas, but there are mountainous terrains and highland areas associated with it. Descartes and Framaro. Framaro is just to the east of our own landing site, but it's in the highland area to the east of Site 7.
Highland, rough terrain, mountains?
Yes, that's exactly right. And unfortunately, for training purposes, the ranger pictures of these particular areas leave a little bit to be desired as far as our requirements are concerned.
You say Ranger. Now, this was an early photographic spacecraft.
That's correct.
Do we have lunar orbiter or surveyor pictures of any of these?
I think all of those have added to the information and the photography that we have of these areas, mm-hmm. but they are not adequate to do the job that we're talking about.
For future manned missions.
That's correct.
In these areas.
That's correct.
Because what are you
to land in highland areas, I think you must recognize that you've got to find an area that is suitable for landing. You can't land a limb on the side of a mountain. That ought to be obvious. And I think we've got to detail these areas well enough so that we can find adequate landing areas. But not only do they have to be adequately found, they have to be adequately identified and charted so that we know exactly where they are. Plus the fact that the techniques of spot landing with the limb have to be developed. We haven't done it yet. We're going to attempt it on this one. But the more we try and the more we do this, I think the more we'll learn so that someday we can, in fact, park that limb on a plateau that's right alongside of a mountain. Now, this is the type of thing we're interested in. Several of these things that we'll be doing will be strip photography of the areas leading in to these landing points. In other words, recognition of specific features that give us this ability to track inbound to the target. Plus some high-resolution photography with a 500-millimeter lens where we employ the technique of target motion compensation so that we can get the resolution that is inherent in the equipment, something like 1 meter from 60 miles.
You mean the resolution of your pictures will be within 1 meter from
60 miles with a 500-millimeter lens? That's correct, if we can properly employ the target motion. In other words, if we can adequately point the camera at the target as we're going over it so that there is no motion on the film, that the resolution can be down to 1 meter. Now, these are the type of pictures you have to have so that people can really study the terrain and find the areas that are suitable for landing the limb. There are two other significant aspects of this. One is a strip photography. I guess I mentioned that, of the strip photography of the track inbound to these targets so people can recognize where they are. The other aspect of it is tying down where these areas are on the lunar surface so that navigational processes will be more accurate.
Is part of the strip photography this complete track of the moon from
yes,
during one full pass?
We're doing that on two passes. We're doing it with the sextant camera. We call it the DAC, which is a data acquisition camera mounted on the sextant, and tracking in a stereo strip all the way across this particular track. Additionally, we use the P-22 program, which is a landmark tracking program and a command module that we can track a specific spot and through the process of the program come up with a longitude, latitude, and altitude for that particular item that we're looking at or that particular landmark. And tying our particular orbit to that landmark allows us to adequately plan future missions so they can use these same features in the same areas and they'll know exactly where they are.
That was Rhett Turner talking to Dick Gordon, the command module pilot, who will be taking some photographic pictures, and they will be of future landing sites. Bill Land, I was going to ask you, you have completed one primary objective in the mission of Apollo 12, and that's developing the technique for a pinpoint landing capability. Is there any possibility that you can refine this even to a further degree?
Norm, I think that we actually found out on this mission that we won't have to refine it any further than we did. The only possible refinement would be in that maneuver that was conducted after they took over manual control following low gate or below 500 feet, where they, as they approached the lunar surface, they began to kick up a lot of dust and lost sight of where they were. Now, that was in about the last 50 feet, as I recall. They started seeing dust. And then about the last 30 feet, the dust clouded things up to an extent that they couldn't see their landmarks or where they were touching down. But at that point, they were conducting a vertical descent, and they had already selected their spot. So it really didn't interfere with where they landed. I think that knowing, however, that we can expect such a great cloud of dust, they'll probably be a little more precise in selecting their spot after they go below low gate, such that they will know exactly where they're going to land. Now, when I say exactly, I mean within just 2 or 3 feet, rather than within maybe 50 or 60 feet, as occurred on this flight. However, the navigation, which led up to this pinpoint landing, was excellent, and I don't see how we could do any better.
Well, let's go to Mission Control at Houston for a late status report from Rhett Turner.
We should have acquisition of signal on the command module in about 15 minutes from now, about 18 minutes, 3 minutes later, on the lunar module. All has been quiet. I had one comment to add to what you heard Dick Gordon talking about a moment ago on the resolution of those pictures they're going to be taking during this extra day in orbit around the moon. Dick, it impressed me also as rather amusing. That's the most we've heard from Dick Gordon in several days since he's been quietly and passively watching all of this activity on the lunar surface. Now he's coming into his own in command of the Yankee Clipper, the mother ship. But the very purpose of those pictures they're going to be taken is the need for them, and their best use is beautifully proved when you review this pinpoint landing technique, because the thing that made Pete Conrad so excited as he was descending to the surface of the moon after he pitched over the lunar module Intrepid, and he could see the craters coming up in front of him exactly as they had appeared in his simulator device. Here on Earth, in the training procedure, the men in Mission Control and the training crews over in the Flight Crew Operations Division at the Manned Spacecraft Center actually build surface models from these photographs brought back from either lunar orbiter pictures or from earlier spaceflight pictures. That's why such an emphasis on photography. It gives the flight planners and the crew trainers the materials they need in order to build models. Then these models are used in the simulators, which the astronauts fly hundreds and hundreds of times. So when the window of the spacecraft pitched over, when the spacecraft pitched over and Pete could see lunar terrain under him coming up, he knew exactly where he was. A very prominent crater was, as Pete said, exactly where it's supposed to be. Fantastic. And he He was so excited because he knew everything he saw in reality from the simulations he had flown, and all of this was made possible by the extremely accurate photography brought back from earlier flights. So Dick Gordon's comments there on photography are appropriate to this very important point, and that will be even more important in highland areas in which future flights will land. That's about all I have to comment here at the moment. We're passive, in a passive mode at this moment, too. 12 minutes until acquisition of the command module, 15 minutes until acquisition of signal from the lunar module.
Bill Land, we had a very successful second EVA on the lunar surface, and there was a trip to the Surveyor 3 instrumented craft resting on the side of a crater. What was the purpose of this trip?
Well, as you know, that was a secondary objective of this flight and not primary. However, we're very happy to have been able to perform that particular exercise. The reason we went to the Surveyor spacecraft and took a look at it, and in fact took some parts from it, was to observe the effects of a long-duration stay on the lunar surface and see what happens to the material, to see what happens to the electronics components, and also to see what happens to the microorganisms that we knew left Earth in some of those parts. Specifically, we picked up five basic parts from the Surveyor spacecraft, and these consisted of a piece of aluminum tubing, which would provide general exposure effects on the surface to see what happens to a metallic substance. The TV camera, which will tell us something about what happens to electronics after they stay there for a length of time. By the way, this is almost 3 years that spacecraft was on the surface. We also recovered a piece of the TV cable, and inside that cable, under the insulation, there were microorganisms that were left there as the article was produced. And we know how many and what types of microorganisms these were, such that when we bring them back, we can find out if anything occurred to those, whether they just plain died or whether they mutated or what might have happened. Also, they picked up some glass parts, and I'm not quite sure exactly whether they picked up a glass piece intact or pieces of glass, but in any case, they have glass pieces or a part that will indicate the effects of cosmic rays and the solar wind, and also possibly micrometeorite hits. Something that we had not counted on bringing back, but which the crew is reported to have picked up, was the scoop, which was used in picking up dirt or picking up soil from the lunar surface just after the Surveyor landed. As you might recall, that operation was televised, and we could see that scoop go into the surface and pick up some dirt such that we were able to tell the texture and general content. This will be very interesting to see what happened to that after its operation and its stay on the surface.
Has any thought been given to a return possibly in the future to an Apollo landing site to examine the descent stage, which remains on the lunar surface?
I think that will happen sometime in the future. Right now, we are not planning on revisiting any of the sites because we have a rather ambitious scientific program which calls for going to various and distant areas of the moon. In fact, as the program develops, we will be going to different types of sites for the purpose of obtaining different types of rocks of differing ages and composition, hopefully. And as we gain experience, we're going further north and south of the equatorial line, or the old Apollo landing zone. I call it old. It's still the Apollo landing zone, but as we become more ambitious, we have found that we can make plane changes, that is, increase our inclination to the equator and land further away from the equator. Now, we'll be doing this both north and south. One spot in particular that comes up very late in our lunar exploration program is the crater Tycho, which I think many people have heard a considerable amount about because it's such a rugged area, and it's located considerably south of the equator. It'll be the most difficult one to get into, and if we do get there, we should learn a great deal more about the moon.
In the future, will you have to expand the capacity of the portable life support systems in order that the astronauts be able to range a little more distant from the craft?
We will be increasing the capability of this portable life support system, or the system that provides the crew with oxygen and cooling during their extravehicular activities. I believe it's Apollo 16 where we will be using the first of the extended duration portable life support systems. And this will be such that the crew can stay out longer. As we saw in this mission, though, we've already got a capability for probably greater than 5 hours due to or from what we've calculated on what was remaining of consumables when they returned from their two EVAs. However, by increasing the stay time, we not only increase the range that the crew can go, but, of course, the activity that the crew can perform, they can perform more strenuous things. In addition to that, we will also be, in the future, taking along a lunar roving vehicle, which is a four-wheeled vehicle capable of carrying the two crewmen to even further distances. Now, combining the duration of their EVA activity, that is a longer duration, with the extended portable life support systems, combining that with the lunar roving vehicle, we'll get a great deal of more capability to investigate scientifically interesting things.
And now let's go down to Houston and Rhett Turner for a late status report.
6 minutes until the command module, Yankee Clipper, should come back into tracking range of the Earth, some 9 minutes before Intrepid is to come around, as they say, come around the backside of the moon. The concentric sequence initiation burn, the CSI burn to circularize the orbit of Intrepid, should have been accomplished about 8 minutes ago on the backside of the moon when the spacecraft reached a high point in its egg-shaped orbit, some 80 kilometers above the surface. So at this point, the Intrepid should have fired its rockets for 45.3 seconds, the reaction control system engine, to impart a delta velocity of 50 feet, some 45 meters per second added to the speed of the spacecraft. This would lift that low point in the egg-shaped orbit up to an 80-kilometer point, and therefore at this point, if all of that came off on time and correctly, Intrepid should be circling around the moon at an equal distance above an equal height of about 80 kilometers. Yankee Clipper is about 100 kilometers and slightly ahead. Therefore, Intrepid would be slowly catching up. Acquisition of signal in 4 minutes 58 seconds of the Yankee Clipper. We'll stand by for that.
This is the Voice of America's continuous coverage of the flight of Apollo 12. Now, 143 hours and 11 minutes into the mission. We'll return to our continuous coverage, but first, let's go to the Voice of America newsroom for a late summary of news.
Moon explorers Conrad and Bean have blasted off from the Ocean of Storms in the lunar module Intrepid in their first step on the long voyage home. They maneuvered into a preliminary orbit around the moon, from which later today they will slowly approach the orbiting command ship Yankee Clipper. The two spacecraft will dock about 3 hours from now. Astronauts Conrad and Bean will climb back inside the main spaceship, and the lunar module will be jettisoned for good. Then the trio will be ready to begin their trip back to Earth and splashdown on Monday. A Nigerian airliner crashed near Lagos, killing all its passengers and crew members. Our correspondent in Lagos reports that there were 75 passengers and 10 crewmen. The plane was on a flight from London, and most of the passengers were thought to be Nigerian Airways personnel. The Austrian Defense Ministry says a Polish airliner was hijacked to Austria. It said the plane, carrying an unknown number of people, passed its original destination of Bratislava and crossed into Austrian airspace. There are no other details as yet. There was no major combat reported in South Vietnam today, but enemy gunners continued shelling Allied positions in the Buprang area of the Central Highlands near the Cambodian border. At the Vietnam talks in Paris, American Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge called once more for serious negotiations to end the war. He said the United States would be prepared to consider any proposal for a mutual withdrawal of troops even sooner than the 1 year it proposed to end the Vietnam conflict. Three Israeli civilians were reported wounded when their car was ambushed and attacked by Arab guerrillas near the village of Jabalia in the occupied Gaza Strip. The incident is the latest in a series of anti-Israeli guerrilla attacks reported from the Gaza Strip in recent weeks. The second working session of the Strategic Arms Limitation Talks in Helsinki got underway Thursday morning. The session at the Soviet embassy was described as preliminary and exploratory. British Prime Minister Harold Wilson will visit Washington in January for talks with President Nixon. It will be his first visit to Washington since Mr. Nixon became president, and President Pompidou of France will come to the American capital in February. That is the news in brief. This is Clark Thornton reporting on The Voice of America.
This is The Voice of America's continuous coverage of the flight of Apollo 12. Now let's go to Houston and Rhett Turner for a late status report.
Let's go to Mission Control.
Had readings from Intrepid at liftoff. Presently, ground-based solutions in the control center indicate that a constant delta height burn of some small magnitude may be accomplished or done on this front side pass. We won't know, of course, until we reacquire Intrepid and get their CSI solution. Ground computations would indicate a burn, a constant delta height burn at 143 hours, 59 minutes, 53 seconds, with a delta V of perhaps 12 to 14 feet per second. This would be done to fine-tune or smooth out the wrinkles in the orbits of the two spacecraft. Intrepid traveling some 15 nautical miles below playing catch-up. While Intrepid is playing catch-up with Yankee Clipper, the individual tasks for Conrad and Bean are probably divided along these lines. Conrad operating the radar and the disky during thrusting programs and making automatic or manual attitude changes. Bean logging all maneuver solutions and systems performance and operating the disky, except when keyboard entries affect control of the spacecraft attitude or thrusting.
That report from John McLeish, the voice of Mission Control.
We have acquisition with Yankee Clipper. No conversation taking place at this time, however.
Yankee Clipper has come into view. The data is coming to the ground.
At 143 hours, 16 minutes.
Should be a call.
We're 2 minutes, 25 seconds away of reacquiring Intrepid.
Jerry Carr, the capsule communicator, should make a call when he gets confirmation of signal lock and ready with the voice network. The voice network, the voice loops, take a little longer to activate than do the data acquisition channels. They want to lock on a little better, the tracking antennas. We'll hear Jerry Carr give a call to Dick Gordon in Yankee Clipper any moment. That's Dick
Yankee
Gordon.
Yankee Clipper, Houston. How do you read?
Hello, Houston. Clipper, loud and clear.
Roger.
Clipper, loud and clear.
Roger, CSI burn was good. Intrepid burn, 45.3 feet per second. My solution was 45.9.
Dick
Roger,
Gordon
Dick.
Reporting on the burn with Intrepid, which hasn't come into view yet. 45.3 feet per second was added to the delta, was the delta velocity. And
that was Dick Gordon reporting the concentric sequence initiate burn was good.
That's just a little less than was called for from the ground.
143 hours, 18 minutes. So when we reacquire Intrepid, we will probably receive a status report on that burn.
Half a minute until acquisition of
Intrepid. Houston, continuing to monitor.
Half a minute until we should hear from Intrepid. Yankee Clipper and Intrepid are now just about... just under 30 kilometers apart in height above the moon. 10 seconds till acquisition. Clipper is in a circular orbit roughly 110 kilometers above the moon.
Major plane change is minus 4/10.
That was Dick Gordon talking to Pete. Clipper is 80 kilometers above the moon, approximately. Slightly below and behind in Yankee Clipper. Should have acquisition by now, and a call from Jerry Carr to Intrepid will be forthcoming. Both spacecraft coming from behind the moon around the east side.
Now processing data on Intrepid, the lunar module.
Signal has been acquired. The data coming in. We'll wait for the voice to be aligned, the voice channels.
Intrepid, Houston, how do you read?
Call from Jerry Carr. We should hear Pete.
Loud and clear, Houston.
That was Al
Bean. Roger, I'll read you the same.
Al Bean says loud and clear, Houston.
Residual pings were plus 1/10, minus 1/10, and minus 3/10.
Residuals from the primary guidance navigation system. Plus 0.1, minus 1/2, minus 0.3.
We'd like to know what your delta Vs were that you loaded.
What delta V did you load in there to call for?
What do you mean, what delta Vs we loaded? We loaded 45.3 feet per second. Is that what you mean?
A-firm.
That was our CSI solution.
Oh, okay.
They used their onboard solution
okay,
for CSI.
Okay, and I've run CDH here, and looks like minus 9 and minus 8, roughly, shows me 59 seconds early at TPI.
Roger.
Then we're not going to make the, that doesn't look like we need to make the out of plane. And we got in the noise level on out of plane, that's going 4/10 of foot per second, and I haven't looked at it yet, but I will in a minute.
Very accurate track, according to Pete's onboard readings, reading off his own primary guidance system. Intrepid asks for a high bit data rate. He says, according to his present calculations ahead, as a result of that CSI burn, they are going to be very close to their constant delta height point of decision. No out-of-plane maneuver will be needed, according to Pete. He's in a good plane with the orbit of Yankee Clipper. He will arrive at
Apollo
TPI.
At 143 hours, 21 minutes now into the flight. We presently show Intrepid and Yankee Clipper at a range of 131 nautical miles with a range rate of minus 75 feet per second.
They're about 200 kilometers apart, some 30 kilometers difference in orbit. Pete says that he looks like...
For your information, I cross-fed on the CSI burn, and that sort of evened me up. And I also switched my DAP load to System A.
It's digital
Roger,
autopilot.
Copy.
The automatic pilot control to, he says he switched it to System A, and according to his onboard calculations, he'll arrive at TPI.
And, my out of plane shows 0.31 miles and 3/10 of a foot per second, so I think we'll forget it.
He's recommending to forget the out of plane maneuver.
Okay,
it's
Pete,
pretty close.
That sounds good. While you got a minute, we had a question about the sequence camera. Did that camera stop right after liftoff?
apparently it did. And then it stopped again several times. That's affirmative. It stopped, and I charged it, and it stopped two or three times.
This is Roger. The sequence camera mounted in the window, which was to watch the moon descend below them as they lifted off. It stopped several times, so there will be an interruption in that film record of that. Let's see if I can get this out now before he says something else. 59 seconds early at TPI, the beginning of terminal phase initiation. That's the final thrusting to bring Intrepid up beside Yankee Clipper. That, of course, is scheduled some hours from now at 1:44 hours, 36 minutes. So that's about an hour and 10 minutes from now before that will come about. And he's reading this projection ahead as a result of the recent CSI rocket maneuver.
I guess nobody else is. Anybody else had to use these window heaters before? Our windows keep fogging over, and I have to run the window heaters all the time.
He's having to run his window heaters. The windows keep fogging over inside the spacecraft, the lunar module.
Intrepid Houston, the folks here say that was pretty nominal on Apollo 11.
Apollo 11 also had to run the window heaters.
Oh, I didn't remember that. Okay, very good.
The interior of the spacecraft at a comfortable room environment temperature, and apparently some humidity there. Slightly fogging the two spacecraft windows, so there are some window heaters which keep this fogging or moisture off of them. Pete has them on. It's performing properly. No need for out-of-plane burn, according to Pete. Dick's calling. Dick is giving him his figures. They're within about 15 seconds of one another in their calculations of the spacecraft trajectory. The game now is projecting ahead. What next? That's the way this sort of...
Dope?
Roger, Pete, I sent you bum dope. 11 did not use their heaters.
Well, there's the word.
I don't remember anybody having to use them. And both my docking window and both Al's window and my window, we've collected moisture on the lunar surface, and we start collecting it here in place. So I put the window heater back on.
Roger.
Pete Conrad.
Just prior to this call up from Mission Control, you heard Pete Conrad and Dick Gordon comparing onboard computation numbers for CDH, the constant delta height maneuver. We're at 1:43 hours, 26 minutes, and now into the flight, and this is Apollo Control, Houston.
So it's very possible that the trajectory, that the orbit is accurate enough now, some 80 kilometers above the moon, for Intrepid to cancel any plane corrections and possibly to even cancel the constant delta height, this trimming maneuver to just refine the wiggles in the orbit. And so everything is all set for terminal phase initiation an hour and 10 minutes from now, approximately, when Intrepid is to begin that final thrusting up closer and closer to the lunar module.
Sure do apologize, Houston, for the overburn. I got my head looking at Al there, and I just shut her off late.
And that's Pete
Roger
Conrad continuing to report back to Earth and going through their procedures aboard Intrepid. We'll report more later.
From the Voice of America, the continuous coverage of the flight of Apollo 12, Norman Guerin in Washington with Bill Land of NASA, and Rhett Turner in Houston. Understandably, the success of a space mission depends on the cooperation of a group of highly skilled specialists located in the Mission Control Center in Houston. Jerry Griffin is the prime flight director for Apollo 12 and has the responsibility of coordinating all activities in his area. He explained the division of responsibilities for each mission to Rhett Turner in Houston a few days ago.
Jerry, you're chief flight director for the mission of Apollo 12. Which of the major events may we see you and your team in charge of?
As the lead flight director, I'll be doing the launch and the translunar injection phases. I'll also handle both of the extravehicular activities on the moon. as you know, this
both of the periods when the guys are outside on the surface.
That's right. And I'll also do the TEI, the trans-Earth injection phase, where we actually start back for Earth. Now,
Are you working in eight-hour shifts, as in past missions?
Approximately 8 hours. That varies a little bit sometime to make it come out even, but by and large, you can say 8 hours. Now, Cliff Charlesworth is the flight director that will be doing the descent to the surface.
Now, he was prime flight director on Apollo 11, as I recall.
That's right. He was prime flight director on 11, this descent is enough of a task that we figured we ought to put one flight director on that pretty much by himself, and that's all he does. We'll follow that same philosophy, I think, from here on out throughout the rest of the program. And in other words, since I'm prime on 12, there's a good chance I'll probably do the descent on 13 mm-hmm. and kind of follow it right down the line each day. The lunar orbit insertion and the plane change that we're going to do photography after rendezvous off the lunar surface will be handled by Glenn Lunny. Glenn, if you remember, was prime on 10. Now, the ascent and the rendezvous will be handled by Pete Frank, who is one of the newer flight directors that was named the same time I was. Pete's also worked on about the same missions I have. And that's the team for this mission.
Mm-hmm. All of you will be able to get a little sleep in there sometime, at least, during a 24-hour day.
That's right. We, I guess as early as Apollo 9, finally went to four flight directors instead of three. We found this worked a lot better. We've got six of us total, so we can play that game, and it makes the work-rest cycle something that's tenable.
Jerry, explain a bit of the organization here at the Manned Spacecraft Center and how flight operations works. All of you, the men you've just discussed, work for Gene Kranz and, in turn, for Chris Kraft. Explain how you report to these men and what they are doing during missions like this.
Okay, that's a good question. Actually, Gene Kranz is kind of a dual role. He is one of the six flight directors that I mentioned before. He's also our division chief. So as the division chief, he reports to our directorate chief, who is Chris Kraft. Now, as you know, Chris, of course, has been in manned spaceflight since manned spaceflight was and or is. And
you are the men that he's trained. That's my point.
That's right. In fact, the original flight director was Kraft. He was the only one that there was.
Now, what does Chris do up there in the front office of flight director, of the flight operations during missions like this? He's really there looking over your shoulders, isn't he?
That's right. Chris does a couple of things. One, of course, pre-mission. He's still our director of flight operations, and he's the man that we're responsible to directly. During the missions, he mans a console, actually right behind the flight director console, called the director of flight operations. And as a result, we have our management right at our back anytime we need them to help with a decision that requires some management.
Right at your back, literally and figuratively.
That's right. And sometimes we hear quite a lot from him. And other times, if things are going smoothly, of course, he's primarily just listening.
Well, the expertise of all the old hands—it's all right there at your disposal, huh? When you're in the hot seat or in the saddle there as a flight director.
That's right, and it's a very comfortable feeling to have those type of people behind you. We have, of course, the flight director is primarily responsible for the operation of that room, and he can always do that. But some of the stickier decisions, it's good to have men like Chris Kraft to help you.
And how many men are there in the mission control in the control room when you're conducting a flight, and how many people in other rooms support you?
Rhett, in the control room itself, there's about 20 to 25 people, and it'll vary a little bit from phase to phase because there are some positions that aren't manned at one time or another. But on the order of 20 to 25 people report to the flight director, and supporting actually those 20 or 25 people in our back rooms, there's probably another 60 to 80, depending on the phase. So at any one time, the flight control function itself is probably staffed by close to 100 people. Now, also in the control center, as you know, we have the computers that are run downstairs. We have the other support areas, display, and that sort of thing.
Thanks, Jerry, for giving us an insight into flight operations.
Right, thank you.
Rhett Turner speaking with Jerry Griffin, Prime Flight Director for Apollo 12. Incidentally, Cliff Frank is one of six flight directors on duty for the Apollo 12 mission sitting in now. Bill Land, there are a couple of additional duties for the astronauts to perform this mission. I'd like to ask you about deorbiting the ascent stage. What do you mean by that?
Norm, on this mission for the first time, we will be impacting the spent or the now used ascent stage on the lunar surface, and that calls for a deorbit maneuver. That will be conducted about one revolution after the crew egresses from the lunar module and they jettison it. The ascent stage then will be free-floating about the moon until the time until it gets around the front side of the moon after it's jettisoned from the command module. And at that time, it will be oriented properly for a retrograde maneuver, that is a braking type of maneuver. That maneuver will be conducted with the RCS jets, just as these other maneuvers have been conducted and will be until a rendezvous. However, now the LEM will be empty. It won't take too much of a burn. It'll be out of fuel, or practically out of fuel, and no crew members in it. The rocks will be transported back to the command module, such that a short burn of the reaction control system thrusters, two of them to be exact, that is the way we're planning it, in the retrograde or backward direction will cause the spacecraft then to lower its orbit such that it will intersect with the surface of the moon. Now, that's just a technical way of saying it will impact on the moon. We're planning this impact or targeting it to occur very close to the landing site for this mission so that when it strikes the moon, the passive seismometer that was deployed as one of the ALSEP experiments will be able to record the impact, and we should get some valuable data from that.
Will it likely disintegrate when it hits the surface of the moon?
It will most certainly disintegrate, I guess, is as good a word as any. It will break up into very small pieces because it'll be impacting at a very high rate of speed. We'll know more about that, we hope, from photographs if the crew is able to track it down to the surface and take some pictures with that sequence camera, which, by the way, was giving them a little bit of difficulty during the ascent phase.
Is that a command from the command module for deorbiter from manned spacecraft center?
No, that's a good question. The way this is done, the crew sets it up for a maneuver, for a standard type of lunar module maneuver. They set it up that way before they leave the spacecraft. There's one safety feature here. While they set it up for the maneuver, they also disengage the ascent propulsion system, or safe it, as we call. That's done so that if a stray command were to get into it, into that computer, and cause it to fire early, nothing, even while it's attached to the command module, nothing serious would happen. However, what happens in the normal sequence of events after the lunar module is jettisoned and comes back around the moon, a command from the ground will be sent up to the spacecraft telling it to proceed with a scheduled burn that the crew had previously set up before they even left the lunar module. Once it receives that proceed from the ground, it will count down automatically via the computer to the burn and conduct what is called an ullage burn with the two reaction control set system thrusters. This short burn then will, I say short, actually it's long by reaction control system burns. It's about 1 minute in duration. But it doesn't provide a great deal of impulse, just enough to lower the orbit so that it will impact. Now, this is by ground command. Just one command will start the engine, and then another command will be sent up to stop the engine at the desired time.
Would a secondary mission be to clear the lunar orbit of extra vehicles?
This is really the primary objective, and I'm sorry I didn't mention that before. The reason that we're deorbiting and impacting it is not for the science, although that is a nice benefit. But it's really to clear the moon of orbital debris, as we call it, things that have been used up and are no longer useful to us. We like to get them out of lunar orbit where they might interfere with future lunar missions.
One of the other missions to be accomplished is a photographic mission in lunar orbit for future landing sites, I assume.
That's right. It's called bootstrap photography, and that term is very appropriate in as much as we're up there to conduct the landing mission and do the science for this mission. However, by staying one additional day in orbit, we're able to take pictures of future landing sites and thereby increase our data supply of information on these sites for future landings. And as we heard earlier in an interview with with Dick Gordon about this, these photographs are very, very important to the following crews, telling them just what they can expect to see and how things will look as they're approaching their landing site. It also provides the information for making three-dimensional models of the site. These are very important also in simulations.
We're now 143 hours and 39 minutes into the mission of Apollo 12. We'll return with our continuous coverage of the flight of Apollo 12, but now let's go to the Voice of America newsroom for... Let's go to Rhett Turner in Houston for a late status report.